Start. Hello and welcome to the Data Journalism Podcast. My name is Simon Rogers. I'm a data journalist, speaker and teacher and data editor at Google.
And my name is Alberto Cairo. I am a professor of visualization at the University of Miami, an infographics designer and journalist, and also a book author.
We love using data to tell stories, and the music you can hear is the sound of data, maybe two-tone, an app that turns data into tunes. And this week, it is the sound of our guests and their workflow.
That's so interesting. Well, this is the Data Journalism Podcast, the only podcast, as far as we know, and at least so far, dissecting the latest trends in data journalism around the world. In each episode, we are exploring the latest in data journalism and chatting with some of the world's top data journalists. You'll get to find out how they do what they do.
So subscribe at datajournalismpodcast.com to see how data is changing the world of journalism forever.
Hey, Simon.
Hey, Alberto. How are you doing?
Doing all right. So can we talk about our guests this week?
Yeah. So this week we are joined by a team of great data journalists who we've actually, full disclosure, we've worked with on projects around really interesting data around the midterm elections that's coming up at the moment. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But this is the Axios Data Journalism team, which is Danny and Jackie and Will. And they're just a fantastic group of designers and engineers and journalists who really understand how to tell stories briefly and simply, but also beautifully.
I think that summarizes the conversation really well. There is something that I really like about Axios's graphics work, which is that, again, it tries to find the middle ground between all those drives or goals that you have just mentioned. They try to tell the story. They try to tell the story as simply as they can, but without losing too much detail that may compromise the quality of the story. So they try to balance out simplicity with depth, which is something that I really appreciate.
Absolutely. And I think their work is so perfectly suited for this time. I think around the need for stuff to be shareable, social, and easily understandable, but also analytical and provide context.
And elegant, because their graphics are truly elegant.
Really absolutely, fun. Absolutely.
So should we get started?
Let's dive in.
My name is Danielle Alberti, and I'm the Axios Managing Editor for Data Visualization.
I'm Jackie Schrag, and I'm a visual journalist at Axios.
And I am Will Chase. I am an associate editor of DataViz, working on the visual storytelling side.
Thank you all so much for joining us. We're so glad to have you here, not least because I've just been admiring your team's work for a while now. And I'd love you to talk a little bit, maybe Danielle, you could start talking a little bit about how the team works and the kind of approach that you guys take to visual storytelling.
That's a really huge question. Our team is currently divided into three parts. We have our daily requests, our storytelling team that is led by Will, and our engineering that's led by Jackie. Clearly, there is a lot of overlap there. Not many people are on one team or the other. There's a lot of kind of back and forth that happens. But on a day-to-day basis, we're taking a lot of requests from reporters. You know, they're working on a story, they have a data set they want to visualize, or they need help finding data that they want to visualize to go along with their story, and they'll come to us and ask for help. And that's probably the bulk of what you're seeing from us. You know, as you follow us, you're mostly seeing those daily requests. On a longer term basis, Will is working on storytelling. I'll let him kind of talk a bit more about that. And then we have a lot of room for my team to kind of pitch their own stories, their own interests and passions. I think that because Axios is not super, you know, we're not that restricted on space. We're not that restricted in subject matter. We have a lot of leeway to kind of find stories that are interesting to us, that make us feel good. And, you know, they like seeing what we produce, what our original content is, what is happening in those brains. So I'm always able to pitch those ideas to editors as well.
You know, following up on Danny's point about the content, that's, to me, that's the most exciting thing about working at Axios is, not to say that there's little oversight, but they strongly encourage you to follow your own ideas. And so, you know, it's, I think it's, I've talked to a lot of other journalists, and I think one of the differences here is that there's not as much editorial, like, quashing of ideas or direction. It's a little bit more bottom up than top down. And so, you know, essentially you have any idea you can think of, a really wacky thing, and they'll just say, you know, sounds cool, make it, and we'll probably find a place for it. And so I think that's sort of my goal, at least, on the storytelling side of things, these longer projects. You know, we've done a handful so far, some trackers, some stories, different types of things. But really, I just encourage the people on our team to, you know, dream up, like, what is the thing that you wish was out there that you want to see, and we'll make it happen.
Great. And Jackie, maybe you could talk through a little bit about some of the kind of the engineering challenges that you have kind of on the day-to-day basis.
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest challenge that the engineering kind of team within the database team has is just how do we scale our processes and our tools as the Axios newsroom continues to grow. You know, most of us on the team joined Axios within kind of the last year. And prior to that, there were just like three or four people on the team, Danny, Will, and Sarah, kind of holding it down. And even in the year that I've been at Axios, like, it's just grown tremendously. And so, you know, one of the things we're doing right now is we're rebuilding our internal chart making tool, which is a tool that allows, you know, any of our reporters to go in, post in their data, decide, like, I want to make a line chart or a column chart or a heat table, write up their headline, and then, you know, they share it with us, so we can edit it and make sure everything's good to go, and then they can publish it all on their own. And so for us, that's just been kind of a challenge. And like, how do you make sure that you're making something that can scale and can be built on? So that way, you know, 2 months from now, when Will is like, can we add like area charts to this? We're able to kind of meet that demand and can do that. We also assist with kind of making sure that like we have a lot of like usable templates that are ready to go. So, you know, every week when it's like, hey, we have to update, you know, the NFL rankings, or we have to update, you know, this other thing, we can easily just grab what we need, update it, just takes a couple minutes, and then republish it. So that way we're spending our time on the more custom stuff that I think most of us really want to be spending our time on.
You sort of like hinted now to the fact that the team has a relatively long history behind, so, and it has grown quite a lot in the recent past. Could we go back to the past, to the very beginning, and can we talk a little bit about what Axios is? Because I don't think that all listeners will know what Axios is, and then also how the team was originally put together, how big it was, and then what the history of it was.
Yeah, so Axios launched in January of 2017. We are an online news organization that, you know, our tagline is Smart Brevity, which is an entire approach to writing news where we kind of make things simple, where we distill down to the most important facts to help people get news quickly. So yeah, we've existed since 2017. At that time, it was just kind of a small startup operating out of Clarendon, Virginia. We're still operating out of Clarendon, but in like one room in Clarendon, Virginia, and kind of starting from the ground up. And at that time, Laz Gamio was the DataViz editor, and he built the entire visualization team, including illustration as well, and built all of the styles, built our original chart building tool, put together the original infrastructure, and started the team. So, you know, we had some of the early members were like Harry Stevens, Andrew Witherspoon, Chris Knipe. I joined in December of 2019 when Laz moved on to the New York Times. And at that time, there were three of us. It was me and two reports. And now, how many are we up to right now? We just put out, we have two people joining. I think we're at 12 or 11, 11 or 12, for just DataViz alone. And then another 10 on illustration. And we are producing a lot now. We have scaled up a ton with local, especially. I think we have 24 cities right now. So we are now producing a lot of visualizations on a day-to-day basis.
So how much does that, you know, actually it's very famous for the smart brevity approach, but how much does that apply to visuals? Is it some, do you ever have somebody saying, oh, that's not Axios?
Yep, like, all the time.
Is Axios used all in that way as a word?
Yeah, we definitely, I think that there are several things that we do in data visualization that we really enforce smart brevity. You know, we don't label our axes. We think that in general, the axes should be incredibly obvious. Like, of course, that is what, you know, of course it's years, or they can be labeled in the head or the deck of the chart. So our axes don't exist. We kind of keep labeling to a minimum. We only label what actually has to be labeled. We don't feel like we have to label every value in in like a line chart, because generally speaking, people only actually need to see the trend line. They don't need to see, you know, exactly 14,000 tons of carbon. So there are lots of different approaches that we take. You know, we also limit how long our tables can be. And frequently, I think that reporters especially tend to have a lot of attachment to keep every single bit of the data that we possibly can. And so something that my team really excels at is trying to get them to narrow it down. What are the important parts? What are the important takeaways? What absolutely has to be there? Cut everything else out. And yeah, we drop the smart brevity line all the time. Like, no, I'm sorry, your table cannot be 50 lines long. Smart brevity. Like, it works.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the storytelling side, this is something we've definitely struggled with at times, because, you know, doing these longer custom projects, they're often inherently just bigger, like in terms of the amount of vertical space that they take up. And so, you know, there's definitely people out there that would be like, well, is that smart brevity? You know, this is like a long form kind of story. My argument to that has always been that twofold, I guess. So one would be that smart brevity is not necessarily just about like the length, the vertical length of your article, as much as it is about not wasting people's time and about keeping them engaged in a story. So I think one of the original, you know, drivers for smart brevity was, if you go to a story where it's just a giant wall of text, a large essay, to a lot of people that turns them off immediately because they're busy, they don't have time, whatever. And so inherently visuals circumvent that problem, because, you know, you're ideally not using as much text, and you're using techniques, you know, whether it's, I don't know, scrolly telling or interaction or animation, that keep people engaged and suck people into a story rather than turn them away. And I think the other argument is just that we, you know, eliminate a lot of words by the use of visuals. So, you know, inherent to the medium of visualization is smart brevity, in reducing that word count. And of course, we try to keep that in mind in our stories as well. You know, even in longer stories, we're again trying to distill to the core message, what really matters, you know, what words can we get rid of, what pictures can we incorporate, and really keeping that in mind as we design the stories.
Yeah, I'll just add on there. You know, I think a lot of people think about data visualizations as kind of living on this spectrum between like explanatory versus exploratory. And I definitely think the smart brevity mindset definitely pushes us towards the explanatory portion of that spectrum more often than not, where we're really kind of distilling down that, like, here's the important bits that you need to take away from this data set. You know, and some of that's like the smart brevity thinking. Some of it also is just like the medium that we work in. You know, most of Axios's readers read our content via like email newsletters, which means you're kind of limited. You can't have tooltips. You can't have a whole lot of fancy interactives and stuff like that. And as someone who comes from a web development background, who my bread and butter was interactive data visualizations, that was a big learning experience for me. But I actually think a lot of our charts are stronger for that because they have a very clear point that they are trying to make. But there's definitely, it's definitely a challenge sometimes to try and get all the information down.
One thing I would add to that is that we do frequently still have interactive graphics. We do frequently have tooltips, but it's really, really important to us that every graphic that we put out needs to be readable completely static. It has to be there. If somebody isn't going to click on it, it needs to be readable. Tooltips, they can be a happy bonus. If somebody wants to do that exploration, that's great. We can absolutely provide that in a lot of cases, but number one priority is that it needs to be readable while static.
Yeah, that's one of the features that I like, one of the many features that I like about your work, that the graphics sort of like work at different levels of depth. So you can simply take a quick look at it and you understand what is going on, but then if you want more detail, then you can navigate the graphic at will if you want. I actually explain that strategy of design to students every semester when they ask about, when should I use interaction? I say, well, when you need interaction, but first of all, present the main point that you want to make, and then interaction is an add-on that you can rely on if people want to get a little bit more in depth into the story. I have another question, because there is something that you hinted before about collaborating with other people in the newsroom. So you said that sometimes you take requests from the newsroom and produce graphics that are requested from the rest of people. Sometimes you take the lead and you create things from the bottom up. What is the balance between those two things? I'm not going to ask you to give precise percentages, right? But what would you say that is the balance between taking requests and sort of like taking the lead and producing graphics that are based on your own interests?
I would say that there isn't quite a balance there. Realistically, it's going to vary a ton from week to week. Sometimes we just get a lot more requests and we're not able to produce a lot of our own work. And other times the requests are really slow and we're just churning stuff out. And frequently, you know, I think that a lot of my best ideas come at completely random times. And I usually just kind of like, oh, well, you know, something on Twitter set off some questions for me, so I'm going to quickly try and find some data and throw something together. And a couple hours later, I have something really cool. So I don't think there's necessarily a balance that's really struck there so much as inspiration. And then, of course, you know, sometimes we're paying attention to the news. We know that we're going to be covering a large news event and we want to see, well, where does data have a place in this? What should we be contributing to this story? I don't think it really is something where we stay very consistent with it. And it's just kind of a matter of the circumstances of the week.
Got it. So let's get into specifics. So about the projects that you were mentioning, give us some examples. I mean, what types of projects that you have produced throughout the years, taking the lead or something, do you feel most, you feel happiest about or most proud of? I'm just saying, just to illustrate and give the listeners links to those projects so they can enjoy your work.
I can start with one, which feels a little weird to say that we're proud of it given the subject matter. But earlier this year, you know, as COVID deaths continued to kind of be on the rise, we in the newsroom were very aware, you know, we're going to be hitting 1 million official deaths in the United States at some point in the upcoming weeks. And that was something that, you know, we knew was coming. We didn't quite know when, but we knew, you know, we needed to be ready for it. Like that is a, you know, that is a milestone that is worth commemorating given what that signifies. And so that started as just kind of a conversation of like, all right, we know it's coming. How can we be prepared about it? And what followed was, you know, a kind of multi-month effort amongst the visuals team and partnering with Tina Reed, one of our health reporters, in creating this kind of long form story that kind of commemorates and kind of points out at different points in the pandemic, here are milestones that we reached. So, you know, within the first couple of weeks, we reached the equivalent of deaths in 9/11. Within, you know, a couple weeks after that, we reached the equivalent of, you know, the Spanish flu, and so on and so forth. And we basically kind of made these parallels of, you know, within 6 months, we'd lost the entire population of, you know, Salt Lake City or other things like that, just to kind of make people feel like, what does that actually mean in real life? Because big numbers are hard for people to kind of relate to and empathize with. And so that was, you know, when we published it in May of this year, it was, you know, really well received. You know, people felt like we handled the subject matter really responsibly and kind of painted the picture. But that was definitely one where it was very much a visuals led project rather than the reporters coming to us and saying, you know, what can you do and put this together? So that would just be one that kind of immediately comes to mind for me.
One I had was that in 2020, I just saw kind of an offhanded tweet saying that that there was a shortage of poll workers in the United States for the election because of coronavirus, because poll workers are by and large a much older population, usually over 65. And so there was going to be a shortage of them in 2020 because so many didn't want to go to a crowded polling place. And I was an election officer a couple years ago. I thought it was a really amazing experience. I thought it was definitely a valuable service. And so I contacted one of our reporters who happened to already be working on exactly the same story. And she was really interested in working with me and hadn't thought about doing some sort of data visualization on it. So together we put together a map helping people find how to register as poll workers in their states. Turns out that it's not always easy to figure out how to do that. And we wanted to help people, you know, find resources for how do you actually get involved. It was a fairly simple map to put together. You know, we had to research 50 states, but that was pretty much it, and then throw together like a clicky map. I guess that's one of the rare occasions where it didn't work super well in static. I was really proud of it because it ended up getting picked up in a lot of places, getting retweeted a lot. And I saw literally hundreds of comments of people saying that they registered to be a poll worker because they saw this story. And I was just really, really proud that this thing that was just kind of like, I saw an offhanded tweet saying that this was a problem and I was able to put this map together, was able to help so many people.
Yeah, I think there are several projects I could choose, but maybe for nostalgia factor, I'll choose the first project I ever did here, which was first large project I ever did, which was our coronavirus variant tracker. Because I think it's a good illustration too of what we were talking about, sort of the visual smart brevity and how we can integrate that into our graphics. This was created back in, I think, like April or something of sort of an April of 2021, which was when the variants were really starting to become a big deal. You know, you were starting to see stories in the news about them. And at that time, you know, there was five or six variants, and it was kind of confusing because there was very few places where this information was centralized. So you just get these news stories, you know, you could search Google and I'd find, you know, three or four dozen news stories about a variant, and they all have different information. How much more virulent is it? Does it cause more severe disease? Can you still get it if you were already infected with COVID? All these questions. And basically there was no clear guidance on these things. And so what we decided to do was take all that information and put it into one page, one dashboard, where it could also be digested super easily. So we took these kind of complex scientific things and distilled them down into like five key points that you needed to know, you know, little 5 to 10 word bullet points. We used like iconography and illustration to make this very scannable. And I got tons of emails from people that said, oh, this is super helpful. We had maps showing where the prevalence was highest of these different variants. And I think it was really fun because it was also like the first large project of this type, like standalone page that Axios had ever done. So at the time, we didn't actually really have a system for publishing these, and I just kind of made it and, you know, asked for forgiveness rather than permission, which almost didn't work out, but it did at the last second due to some heroic efforts from our tech team. And yeah, it was kind of fun. You know, I got a DM from Harry Stevens on Twitter after we published that that said like, whoa, how did you do this? I didn't think Axios was able to do this. So that was fun.
It's always better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Agreed.
But and we'll add links to these projects in the show notes for sure. So one question I had was really around kind of social media, because it feels to me like Axios is like made for the age of social media. I mean, how do you guys have to think about social when you're producing visuals? Like, do you expect them to be shared standing alone, essentially, without any of the context around them?
It's definitely a consideration. And especially with more contentious subjects, I definitely try and think about, like, what is this going to look like if somebody decides to crop it or crop something out and share this without the context of the story? And it's not something that comes up with, you know, it's not part of the editing process. It's not something that we're checking off after, you know, as we look at every single chart. But if we know that it's something that has the potential to be more contentious, sorry to use that word again, we'll definitely look at it and see what can we do to make that harder to manipulate? Because there have definitely been times where somebody kind of like crops things in a way to steer the conversation in a different way or to mislead with our charts. And that gets really frustrating.
Yeah. I'll just add, you know, Axios is a really great social media team. Our comms team is fantastic. And, you know, whenever we are working on visuals like this that we think might get a bigger play on social media, you know, we start contact with them while we're still kind of in the process of designing the visual. And we start thinking about, you know, like, do we have to make alterations? You know, are there certain ways we need to crop it to make sure it works better on Instagram versus Twitter or whatever the case may be? And, you know, they just as we are kind of experts in our domain of data viz, they are experts in theirs in handling whatever, you know, what is social media. And so they're really helpful in coming to us with like, all right, let's modify headlines. Let's make sure that, you know, the description is really good. And so, yeah, we have a great team all around that really makes that possible.
So let's dive straight into the pop quiz. I think what we'll do is we will ask one question to one person, then we can, rather than you all three having to answer each question. So Alberto, do you want to go first with the first one?
Sure, let's begin with that. So I'm going to ask about, so are we supposed to ask just one of them or all of them?
I think let's just ask one, but the others can dive in each time if they want to.
That sounds good. So let's begin with, I don't have a dice to roll here. I'm going to with Danny. So, and Danny, as the question is, could you name one or two books or classes or tutorials that had an impact on you as a professional when it comes to data visualization, obviously, or data journalism at large?
Yeah. One of my very early influences was Nathan Yao's Flowing Data. I think the blog came out right about the time that I was actually starting as a professional in journalism. So, you know, post-college, first job, and really starting to find data visualization. And, you know, I was working in a newsroom where we were doing a lot of data work, but they didn't really have anyone doing data visualization. And I just wanted to learn about this brave new frontier. And that was one of the first things that I that really exposed me to it. And, you know, I bought his first book with newsroom money and was really proud of myself as a young adult journalist expensing a book for my continuing education. And it really did a lot for me. It was really powerful and kind of grasped me early on.
I do think Nathan's work is going to have proven itself to be incredibly influential in the spread of data journalism in recent years, for sure. Okay, I'm going to go to Jackie for this one. If you could keep just one of the tools that you commonly use, what would it be? So everything else has to be thrown away. You can only keep one tool.
God, that's so hard. I think for me, it would probably be my whiteboard and whiteboard markers or pen and paper, which is hilarious because I'm an interactive, like, I'm a web developer. But like, that's how I get out all my ideas, is I just sketch them on whiteboards. You can easily erase. You can easily just kind of iterate. I would be lost if I didn't have a whiteboard.
Love that one.
I guess that the next one is going to be for Will. And then I think that the last one should go for everyone. Let's go with the next one. The next one is, Will, what would you have done if you hadn't gone into journalism?
So if I hadn't gone into journalism, so there was a point in my life where there was like a very, I was very convinced that I was going to go do a PhD on origins of life research. So I was always doing research. I was educated as a scientist. I just dug up today for the team one of my old research papers because it had some really hilariously bad charts in it. And so that was sort of like, I was on the path. My partner at the time, now husband, was, a PhD. He was finishing up his PhD at the time, doing a postdoc. So basically all of my friends and like acquaintances were PhDs and postdocs in science. So it was just sort of like, oh, that's what you do. For a variety of reasons, I ended up not taking that road. And I'm very, very glad that I didn't. I would probably be in a lab right now, very sad, very sad, and wishing I was doing more data visualization.
Sad in a lab, no. Okay, this last one is for all of you, and feel free to dive in. So it's very simple: pie charts or tree maps.
How much nuance do we get here?
as much nuance as you want, or as little nuance as you want as well.
They serve different purposes, and it's
smart brevity.
let's go with small multiple pie charts.
Yeah, I want to dig up that that monstrosity that Jackie and I were like, Jackie was making, and I was giving these edits on it one time. We had a pie swarm chart, and then like a pie stack something, basically tons of little pie charts and circle packing and all kinds of wacky stuff.
That sounds fun. Is that visible anywhere, or it was never published?
Yeah, it never got published, but we have screenshots. We have many screenshots, I think, of when Jackie was prototyping this. So we got to dig those up for you.
Of all my bad ideas.
Yes. maybe I'll answer the question next. Despite the love of pie charts, I think I'll go with tree maps. I don't know. They're fun. I think you can do anything with a tree map. You know, it doesn't have to be squares too. I prefer, in fact, non-square tree maps. You know, there's all these Voronoi tree maps and other different interesting layouts you can use. So.
Yeah, I think I'll go with tree maps, but I definitely, my heart is also with the pie swarm chart that Will and I invented that fateful afternoon.
It is amazing that whenever we pose this question to people who have on the podcast, we get entirely different answers, completely different answers, which is amazing. It's amazing. Well, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for making the time. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.